the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. As always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. And the Fretboard Journal podcast, as you hopefully know, is a part of the Fretboard Journal magazine empire. And if you love our show, if you love hearing these interviews every week at no cost at all to yourself, consider supporting us by getting a subscription to our quarterly keepsake magazine. Right now, we're mailing our 51st issue out to everybody who orders a subscription. This issue has something for everyone, including interviews with Jeff Tweedy, Susan Tedeschi, Derek Trucks, George Groon writing about his favorite guitar of all time, and a bunch of Martin coverage. And I'd love for you to get it. So go to fretboardjournal.com. You can even use the discount code podcast, and I will take $5 off of your order. Today on the show, I am talking to two dear friends who happen to be legends in the world of guitar making. Michael Gurian, of course, of Gurian Guitars and Gurian Instruments, is on the show today, as well as Dick Boak, formerly of Martin Guitars, now building instruments on his own. These two lifelong friends collaborated recently on a book that we happen to put out here at the Fretboard Journal. We have put out our first book, believe it or not. It's called An Instrument Maker's Guide to Insanity and Redemption, and it's a collection of stories that Michael and Dick collect from their peers that spotlight the quirkier, funnier, more unfiltered side of guitar making. It takes a certain type to build instruments by hand, day after day, often in a windowless basement, sometimes in a much nicer facility. And Michael and Dick reached out to their peers, like I said, and got some of these crazy stories that take place when you are toiling away building instruments. Sometimes customers from hell, sometimes the instruments from hell. You name it, it's in this book. It's about 130 something pages long. Folks have been receiving it and getting it. And even though I am the publisher of this title, I didn't really know the whole story behind it. So on today's podcast, I'm talking to Michael and Dick about the making of this book, how it came to be, and all the steps that went into it before it was handed off to me. And now, as I said, you can order it right off fretboardjournal.com. And I'll include a link in the show notes if anybody wants to grab their copy of the book. We are selling them rather quickly, but we still have several boxes here. So nab one while you can. Fretboard Journal podcast is brought to you by a handful of brands that support what we do and love connecting with you all, including our friends at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. I don't know how they keep doing it, but right now they have Rycooters. They've had a bunch of Rycooter instruments over the years. They have Rycooters 1937 Gibson F7 mandolin available. Someone, please nab that. Also from 1937, they have a Martin D18 with the advanced bracing and the wider nut. Some bluegrass player is going to want to grab that. Again, you can go to retrofret.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. It's always helpful to tell the brands that support our show that you appreciate them. We are also brought to you by our friends at Peghead Nation, my favorite music instruction portal. If anybody out there wants to up their game, whether they're playing mandolin, guitar, banjo, you name it, go to Peghead Nation. You can get your first month free or $20 off of your annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. We are also brought to you by our friends at Stringjoy Strings. Stringjoy is making incredibly cool acoustic and electric strings down in Nashville, Tennessee. And if you haven't checked out their products yet, I encourage you to do so. You can do bulk orders, you can do custom gauges. They've got all sorts of variations that you can't necessarily get with the bigger string companies. Just go to stringjoy.com and read up on all that they are offering. Last but definitely not least, our podcast is brought to you by our friends at Deering Banjos. Yes, we have a new sponsor, Deering Banjos. You can go to deeringbanjos.com. Some of you out there probably are already playing banjo, but for all of you out there who are banjo curious, go to deeringbanjos.com. There's a reason why Tony Trischka and Allison Brown and Jens Kruger and Bela Fleck and Mark Johnson and all of these incredible players gravitate towards Deerings. They're just consistently made roadworthy banjos out of the box, made by some of the coolest people in the industry. And I want you to check out what they're up to at deeringbanjos.com. I know people hate it when I ramble at the beginning of these intros, so let me just add, over on fretboardjournal.com right now, there's a Luthier on Luthier podcast episode with Larry Robinson that you should all check out. We also have a video that I shot with Jake Getty, who usually is playing a Martin guitar. He's playing Wheelhouse by Bill Monroe on the 50s Harmony Stratotone that I purchased from our former podcast guest, Duncan Price. Jay Getty on an electric guitar is something to behold, and everybody should check out this video. I'm just going to leave it at that. And then the final thing I want to say is, if you like Dick Boak, if you like Michael Gurian, and you want to connect with him, we've got a Fretboard Summit taking place this August in Chicago, August 24th to 26th, 2023. At Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music. You can go to fretboardsummit.org to read up on it. There is a 50 luthier guitar show. There are all sorts of workshops, programs, mini concerts, big concerts, and parties that you will get to attend as an all-access pass holder. This is really a great way to meet some of the many personalities you've heard on this podcast, read about in our magazine, or just daydreamed about meeting. It is very rare that you can walk in one building and meet the folks behind Collings Guitars in 1 minute, and then meet the folks at Martin and Yamaha, and then meet folks like Ken Parker or Megan Wells or TJ Thompson or Dick Boak. But you can do all of those things at the Fretboard Summit, and we've created programming to kind of allow you to meet them in a really meaningful way. You're not just seeing them on stage, you're getting to hang with them, you're getting to sometimes play music with these folks. It's a very unique model. It is not like what most people think of when they think of a guitar show. And that all access pass allows you to come to all the crazy parties. I've got game shows planned. I've got an open mic comedy night, all sorts of random weird stuff that I'm going to throw at you. And you might hate some of it, but you might love some of it. And I guarantee you, you will never forget attending the Fretboard Summit. That's my promise to you. So go to fretboardsummit.org. And now that I've been a total windbag, here is my conversation with Michael Gurian and Dick Boak about the new book that we all three put out called An Instrument Maker's Guide to Insanity and Redemption. It is available on fretboardjournal.com right now. Michael Gurian, Dick Boak, thanks for talking to me. We've been talking a lot about this book that you guys... You handed me the finished manuscript, I think, at the Fretboard Summit last August, and I was floored. It's a collection of stories from folks in the guitar making and repair community, and they're not the typical, here's how to do an X-Brace story, here's how to do whatever story. They're the fun stories, and I don't even know how the I don't even know the origin story for this book and who had the idea and where it came from.
Well, I think Michael had the idea, and I was out in Bremerton visiting Michael, and we're, I think, in his office, and I looked on, and on the windowsill, there was a file folder with a little stack of maybe 20 letters, papers in there, and I picked it up and started looking. I said, "What is this?" And he said, "That's the solicitation of stories that I have been collecting from my guitar making friends." And I said, "Well, I'm taking this, you know, because I wanted to turn it into a book." And I had the capacity to do that, at least layout and everything. And so I took the folder, and I got everything typed in, and I started the layout, and I realized that it's not enough. There wasn't enough stories there to make a book. And I also realized that I had connections through the luthier support group and different lists that I was part of. And I started out by targeting a couple of key people, and eventually sent out a group text to all of the luthiers, and the stories came pouring in. I pretty much just took them in order and started laying up the book and doing some edits, and not enough edits evidently, because you had to make like 2,000 grammatical corrections.
Yeah, it was all little stuff.
It all came together, and Michael and I wrote our introductions and got it all laid up and sent to you. So that's the basic story. Michael, you want to chime in here?
Well, I conceived this book when I retired, and I said, and a lot of people asked me, "Why don't you write a story about yourself?" And I said, "No, I'm tired of writing about me or talking about me. I'm part of a community that's an amazing, amazing community of people, musicians, builders, repair people, and so on." I said, let them tell a story about themselves and let me put together a book. And I came up with the title, An Instrument Maker's Guide to Insanity and Redemption, which is basically the statement in the front of the book with the guitars burning, because every guitar maker that I know of has made more than one mistake and wanted to clear his mind and his head of that insanity of the mistake and how they destroyed it. Is the fire worked out really well. In any case, that was the concept of the book. And when Dick came over and visited, and I showed him the, I think it was about at least 50 that I had put together 3 years ago, but was not able to finish it. I was having a hard time. I was having basically writer's block or whatever you want to call it. And basically it was the editing problem. And then between Dick and I, Dick especially, organizing, which he's very good at.
I'm not very good at anything else, but I am good at that.
We put this book together and I'm very excited by it. And there are some people in there that wrote their stories before passing on. Recently, Steve James has a wonderful story in there, and he just passed away about a week or so ago. It's a good read and a good idea. Gives people, especially players, a good idea of what somebody goes through, what the instrument makers go through in order to build an instrument. And that's my bird going nuts.
Your bird is going to outlive us all, right?
Yeah.
So yes. The stories. Yeah. Let me break in here and say that this into a couple of different categories. There's the customer from hell stories, all of the luthiers, guitar makers, instrument makers have lots of customers from hell stories that are often really funny. There's interactions with celebrity or famous musicians. There's some sentimental tribute type of stories. There's kind of shop disasters, things that happen in the shop that should never happen. Can you think of any other categories, Michael?
Well, there's advertising. A lot of a lot of guitar makers wanted to talk about how they wanted to sell a guitar and how to get some more customers and stuff like that. But all in all, some of the stories are just fantastic.
Hilarious.
And, yeah. Did you guys give the folks who submitted stories any parameters? Because they all do kind of fall into those categories. The customers from hell, the working with wood is not as easy as you think. And then, you know, a couple other categories, but did you tell them to do anything?
Yeah. I wrote three personal stories, which you'll see in the book, basically giving them examples of what I was looking for.
And we sent those stories to everybody. And we also had a paragraph basically explaining that we're looking for humorous, shop stories, what, et cetera, a couple of little descriptive parameters.
Yeah.
Got it.
So I thought it was trying to think of the word. Well, give me a moment. Somebody else talk.
I just want to interject here that, Dick, yes, you are good at organizing and book layout. But you guys both suck at retiring. Dick, you left Martin Guitars after forever, and you're already now making guitars and like going to guitar shows just like the old days. Michael, you retired, but then now you're building instruments again. You guys need to relax, take up golf, do something.
Why do you Why do you do that? It's your hobby. It's your love. It's your passion. Why would you give up something that's so wonderful? And as I said, it's the greatest privilege of my life given to me by this community. The best people I've ever known have been in this community. It's unbelievable. It's one of the things, it's the universal language of this world, music, and the people involved in it, whether it's building instruments or playing instruments or singing or whatever. It is what it's all about as far as I'm concerned. And for me, it's a full circle, starting as building with instruments, and keep going, ending with instruments. The one thing that I was trying to remember was recognition. Instrument makers, personal instrument makers, not the big companies, though they are in the book, don't get as much recognition as they should. When I first started out, I was doing classical guitars, and I'd go to the concerts, and all on a lot of the itinerary of the concert, there would be the name of the instrument maker. He would be recognized at the concert, not only the musician who was playing the instrument, but the instrument itself. The acoustic guitars, the only recognition is on the headstock, and that's it. But they don't get any recognition. Very rarely have I seen recognition on album covers or anything like that. And it's kind of sad in a way, because if it wasn't for the instrument makers, there wouldn't be any musicians playing. Yeah. And they should be given recognition. So,
no, it's a great point. I mean, we were just before we recorded talking about the late, great David Crosby, and I can't remember a show where he didn't mention Roy McAllister and Martin guitars. Like, he always made a point of exuberantly talking about his tools of the trade, and we just don't get enough of that.
Yeah. I think it's important that people recognize that, you know, without us, they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This book compiles, I mean, all the heavy hitters of the acoustic steel string guitar movement, as well as, you know, some folks like Paul Reed Smith. And what struck me was everybody's got a pretty good sense of humor. And I'm not sure that you necessarily pick up on that when you go to a Woodstock or an artisan guitar show or any of these shows, because everyone's just kind of standing around and putting on their game face. Is having a sense of humor necessary if you're a guitar maker?
Well, I think so, because you're certainly not going to be laughing at the money you're making. As it is. You got to laugh at something. I think we've had starting in the 70s and 80s, we tried with the Guild of American Luthiers and the Association of Stringed Instrument Artisans to gather together the tribe, more or less, to put together a sense of community for the instrument makers. Mm-hmm. And that was really, really important. And it worked. So I think there's some very, very deep friendships that pervade the whole instrument making community that go back, 4 or 5 decades now. And we have a lot of shared memories and a lot of fun times together.
Yeah, there's also just this incredible, and it's mentioned in many stories, this, you know, mentorship process that goes down, and apprenticeships and learning from the elder statesmen, even when they're not that much older than you, which you just don't even see anymore.
Yeah.
In other things.
Well, you know, when I first started out, and this was in the early 60s, no one in the instrument makers trade shared secrets or anything. There was very little information. And as time went on, there was more and more sharing. And today, it's a community of sharing. Instrument makers are a community of sharing and giving. if somebody needs something, they'll find somebody that'll get what they need, give them what they need.
I don't even know, Michael. How did you learn how to make an instrument? There were no books. There was no YouTube. There was no Stumac.
Yeah, there was one book by Sharp that was about 50 pages, maybe, and not that much information. I started in New York. I started by finding an instrument in the garbage and got interested in putting it together, back together again. I was playing and teaching classical guitar, the guitar workshop out in Roslyn, Long Island, as well as playing professionally on weekends. And I needed a guitar. So I took the guitar that I had, which was a Pinheiro guitar, made by Victor Manuel Pinheiro, who worked for Manuel Velasquez. And I looked at it and examined it and tried to figure it all out. And that that was a joke in a way, because I glued it together with bricks and rope. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about woodworking tools, so I spent a lot of time in libraries learning about woodworking tools and how to use them. And somehow or another, the first one got put together. And that was the beginning of building. And I loved building. I got more and more involved because I was able to put together artistic abilities with musical abilities into one wonderful instrument. And that's how I got started.
And then what was the first guitar or instrument that you made after that repair?
It was a classical guitar. That was the one that I copied from Victor Manuel Pinheiro.
Okay. There was no way to get, I mean, I don't think there was no place to order like kerfing or any of the stuff people take for granted, right?
No, there were.
Wait, you could go to H.L. Wild in New York City.
Exactly.
And there weren't many places, but there were a couple.
Metropolitan Music on Park Avenue South.
Okay.
And International Violin Company in Baltimore. And those were the three companies. But the old man, H.L. Wild, he for some reason really liked me. And he used to take me down to his secret stash down in the basement with the cockroaches and rats.
Where describe this store, because it comes up a few times and I've always been fascinated by it. I don't think there are any pictures of this place.
No.
How big was it?
It was a typical shop about 20 feet in diameter and going back about 75 feet.
Okay.
And the old man ran it with his daughter, Anne, and she took over after he passed. It was in the Lower East Side, so you'd have to take your life into your own hands in order to get there. In fact, one time on Avenue A and 11th Street, I got stabbed by a crazy man with a screwdriver going to visit him.
So dangerous to get there, and then on the way back, doubly dangerous because you're carrying all this wood and you can't run as fast.
Exactly.
Okay.
It was a trip, but it was a great beginning. And then I got very much involved with the Classical Guitar Society in New York, and Manus School of Music and Juilliard, and they were pretty much sponsors and helped me out. Suzanne Block was a teacher of lute, and Aubrey and Bolatine, Classical Guitar Society, and Manus School of Music, they supported me as well.
Incredible.
Yeah.
You guys both made instruments back in the day, took a break doing other things. Michael, supplied parts to every major manufacturer, herringbone, bridge pins, all sorts of stuff, not far from where I'm sitting. Dick, you, of course, worked for Martin. Going back into instrument making, is it easier? Does it feel like you're starting from scratch again? Like, how has it been?
Well, it certainly is easy now. And I was recalling my start. I found out about the possibility of making instruments from the Whole Earth Catalog. Mm-hmm. In fact, Michael Gurion was listed in the Whole Earth Catalog as being a source of information. So that's how I found out. And Irving Sloan had written a book called Classical Guitar Making. And he followed up that book with a second book about steel string guitar making. And then David Russell Young came out with a book. And that was really my foray into instrument making. That was before I started at Martin. I was getting scrap woods out of Martin's dumpster when I was teaching art at a private school in New Jersey. And I used to go by Martin almost every week and check the dumpster. I got some really great parts, and that's how I started to build my bow instruments, which were really just unbelievable catastrophes and embarrassments to the instrument making trade. And it wasn't until I got my job at Martin that I really became familiar with what an instrument really is. And that helped my instrument making. I had a great shop in my little gallery home, which was called the Church of Art in Nazareth, and took on some apprentices and built a lot of electric and acoustic guitars, and then kind of set it all aside for the 40 years of my career at Martin. And after I retired, I had saved a stack, about a foot tall stack of very, very special guitar woods that I had saved for my retirement, I guess. And I started building again. So I've built 14 guitars and two ukuleles in the last 2 years, really kind of pandemic guitars. And I don't know what to do with them all. I have guitars all over the place. I shouldn't broadcast that. But I decided I needed to find some homes for them. So I sent one to John Mayer, who's been just a fabulous friend and supporter of mine over the years. I sent one to Jeff Daniels, the actor, who is an extraordinary guitar player and songwriter. I sent one to Steve Miller. As a matter of fact, I hand-delivered it over the weekend to him. It was a Brazilian rosewood Adirondack spruce dreadnought. And I gave one to my local friend, Craig Thatcher, who's kind of the guitar star of our little community here in Eastern Pennsylvania. So that feels pretty good to kind of launch them and let them have a life of their own.
Yeah. Are you going to sell these?
No, I didn't really build them to sell. It's not. Yeah. I think the minute money becomes involved, it becomes a whole different thing. It's not what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm not wealthy, but I don't need money from the guitars that I made. So I'm very attached to them. Yeah. It's very hard for me to part with them. I have, months, 100 hours or, lots of time invested in each one. And they're special, So if I do give them away, it has to be meaningful.
Yeah.
So, Dick, you were building guitars all the way through Martin, whether you knew it or not. You did a lot of design work and a lot of amazing things. And I know I was part of some of them, one or two of them. And so you never stopped building. You just...
I like to say that I caused guitars to be made during that period of time. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I'm so thankful for the career that I had. I had a lot of helpers.
Yeah.
And I had Chris Martin behind me too, which was really, really important.
Totally. Coming back into instrument making after decades away, did you go wild with the construction, both of you? Because I know, Michael, you've made a couple of very personal instruments as well that weren't necessarily for resale. It was just close to your heart. Did you go wild? Did you do something different than back in the day?
They were given away. The instruments of today comprise everything that you've picked up over 60 years. Mm-hmm. So it's all intuitive. I mean, you don't forget. You maybe get a little funkier with your hands, but you don't forget the feel on how to build the instrument and make it right. And they came out great, surprised the hell out of me, because, it's been a while. I've been very much involved in, between building instruments and Gurian guitars, making parts for the whole industry. I mean, the one thing I got a smile at is pretty much every major manufacturer and quite a few smaller builders have my stuff in it. I look at them and I say, oh, yeah, that's my herringbone. That's my my bridge pins, that's something to feel good about, that a little part of me is going forward.
Yeah. That's right. My guitars are mostly kind of Martin-inspired sizes and shapes, of which there are very many. But I'm struck by the process of instrument making. Things can go wrong. I had a set of Zuricotes. Zuricote is like Brazilian rosewood, only it's kind of black like ebony. I had a beautiful, beautiful book match of this, and I wanted to use it, but the problem was there was two terrible cracks in the wood up in the shoulders of the set. And so I marked them out and I simply cut around the defect and made a guitar it's still basically guitar shape, but as it comes up, it swoops and forms kind of almost a Weizenborn shape. I called it the aardvark because it looked like a snoot. And it was just a recovery, a desire to use the wood, and a recovery from an original design into something unusual. And I liked it so much, and it sounded very good. I liked it so much that I made a second one called the Aardvark 2. So I did divert a little bit from traditional guitar design just out of a necessity and a desire to use up materials that really wanted to be guitars.
That guitar, which I saw at the Fretboard Summit, the Aardvark, but I did not play because I was running around like a chicken with his head cut off, was super remarkable. And I wanted to see it up close. And I'm just curious, does the double cutaway, audibly, is there much of a difference?
Oh, no, not really. I'm not sure how much, after making that guitar, it makes me wonder how much of the sound is really coming from above the waist. The aardvark has a waist, but it doesn't have a whole lot of surface area above the sound hole. So it still sounds fantastic. I think most of the sound is coming from below the sound hole.
Well, that's what I found, is the above the sound hole is all the dead zone. It doesn't exist. And what you're saying is absolutely correct. It was a great sounding instrument. I heard it.
Yeah. Did that go to someone famous?
No, I kept that one. I gave it away. I have two daughters, and my daughters really want my instruments, and they get all bristly every time I give one away. They said, "Hey, what are you doing? You're giving away my inheritance."
I love it. What's your take on the future of this handmade guitar movement? Obviously, this book has some folks like Megan Wells in there who are the younger generation, but do you think that more and more people are going to be doing this, or are what's the status? What's the fate of this unique movement here?
Well, I'll jump in and say that when Michael and I started, and Michael is what, Michael, you're 30 or 40 years older than me. When we started, it was very, very difficult to get information about guitar making. Nowadays, there's so much information and so many suppliers of parts and prefabricated aspects of the guitar. You can order bridges and linings and tops and braces and kits and everything. It's so easy. There's so much information and there's so many materials that it's so easy for anybody to simply start to make guitars. They can make their first guitar and hang out their shingle that they're a master guitar maker. And there are thousands of people doing this. And companies like Allied Luthery and Stuart McDonald are cashing in on this by furnishing parts to these hundreds and hundreds of budding guitar makers. Whether they make one or 10 or 100, I think the prevalence of independent handcrafted guitar making is just going to continue to escalate and skyrocket.
I'd say it's even gotten more so since COVID. People were locked up in their houses. They had nothing to do, so they either started playing more instruments, and I know there was a big surge in sales and instruments, as well as builders buying parts, people interested in building an instrument as well. So, we've got a whole new generation based on COVID coming forward.
Yeah. Everybody's trying to work with their hands. Sometimes I feel like the instrument part suppliers are the only ones making money in this biz, but I don't know.
Dix learned how to print it. That's why he doesn't.
You guys both came from massive workshops. The Martin factory, I can't call a workshop, but back to your house, are there any tools you wish you had that you just don't have access to that you had 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Well, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I started with hand tools. I didn't even have a router for the first 50 instruments. Uh-huh. So it's no big deal for me. In fact, I could tell you a funny story about how good I got with hand tools.
These are like Fred Flintstone, kind of
a sledgehammer. Yeah. In New York, there was a company by the name of I.T. Williams & Sons. It was a major wood supplier, and they had sawmills around the world and so on. And they were probably at the twilight of their existence. When I went there, it was uptown on, I think it was 28th Street and 11th Avenue, when I went to their place, and they still had these massive planks of pattern grade Sweetina or Honduras mahogany, 3 inches thick. Some of them were 45 to 48 inches in diameter and 30 feet long.
Okay.
And without a floor. This was just the most beautiful wood you'd ever see. And I bought a plank, and I met the owner's son, Tom, who was in his 70s. IT was in his 90s. And asked if I could come back the next day and saw the plank up, because there's no way I could have moved it. And I sharpened up two crosscut saws and went back there. And the next day, and cut the plank up. And they couldn't believe how fast I could go through that wood without a power saw. And I became very friendly with Tom. And when they closed the company, I asked him, he had two pictures of giant trees, giant sequoia trees in his office. I asked him, if you do decide to ever give it away, give those pictures away. I'd love to have them. And I have them to this day. And it impressed them, because even then, they always thought everything had to be cut with a power tool. And my shop now has not that many power tools, but my hand tools are still sharp and good as ever. So,
was it all sharpness, or was it technique too that allowed you to cut that plank so quickly?
That was a very sharp saw. I used to sharpen those saws myself. Everything.
Yeah. How much did that plank cost you?
It was like, I think I paid $2, $1.80 a board foot.
Which is 1,000 board feet.
Yeah, it almost broke me. But it kept me in wood for a while, quite a while, at least neck wood.
Incredible. Dick, what about you? Do you have to go out of your house to get some things done, or are you going back to basics?
I don't have a flatbed sander or anything. I have a tiny little tabletop sander. I have a little tiny Inca bandsaw. I've got a table saw and a drill press. That's all. Everything that I do is pretty primitive. I feel like I'm kind of a caveman in my guitar making. I had to make my two spruce. I've been making spruce gooses, all spruce guitars, and I made the neck out of a billet of solid 3 inch thick Sitka spruce, and I bandsawed the basic shape out, but I had to do everything with draw knives and rasps. Really, it's just there's a lot of joy for me in doing things the hard way. Mm-hmm. And taking my time with it, I get a lot of satisfaction from that. So, I don't have any technology. I do have a community of Martin people, some of which are retired around me. People that are an expert in pearl inlay, an expert in body assembly, an expert in binding, an expert in fretting. If I get in trouble and need to be rescued, there are people that can rescue me.
What's an all spruce guitar sound like?
Well, it has kind of a throaty clarity, a little bit of texture, a little bit of growling. It's hard to explain, but I would kind of compare it to maybe a little bit closer to mahogany, certainly closer to mahogany than rosewood sound. It's a clear sound with a little bit of texture to it. It's pleasant. And I built two back in, probably 35 years ago, I built two of them. And they came out so well that Martin decided to make a batch, with my prodding. And Martin made two that came out really well. And I revisited it recently, thinking that I could really do a better job now. And so I have a 12 fret and a 14 fret model. The 12 fret is going to be a baritone with a 27.5 inch scale. And the 14 fret is pretty much a standard dreadnought. They're going to be better than the instruments I made 35 years ago, and those guitars are still very good.
Is the back thicker than the top?
No, I didn't really worry too much about thickness. I usually started the thickness was about 118 thousandths, a little bit less than an eighth of an inch, and then I hand sanded down from there. But I didn't really get obsessed with how thick everything was. I just built, like I said, I build with intuition. I pack up everything that I know about instrument making and just kind of throw it all into the mix. And what comes out of it is usually pretty good, pretty workable, and good sounding.
Yeah. Spruce is a lot easier to get than some of these exotic tone woods people are trying to chase. It's pretty cool.
I'm actually trying to encourage a lot of the makers to give it a shot, because I think it's a viable... I think an all spruce guitar is a viable tone wood.
Is it hard to get the sides?
Yeah, you have to. That has to be done kind of specially. And I contacted Steve McMinn, mm-hmm. Who supplies spruce to Martin, and he cut me some sides, and that was really kind of him.
Yeah, Pacific Rim tone woods. They were just visiting me last week here in Seattle.
Yeah, he's indispensable.
Yeah. Well, what's next for you guys? Are you, or Dick, are you going to do another batch of instruments? I hope you are.
Well, I'm thinking about it. I kind of ran out of wood, but I'm thinking about it. I have a request from a pretty good friend that wants a cutaway guitar, and I have a couple ideas that I'd like to do. I'd like to make some OMs, really. I'd like to do a Spruce Goose as an OM, because I think that might be a sweet spot. But yeah, I might get it going again after I'm done with these two.
Mm-hmm. You can always pick on me to get some wood.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Love picking on you.
I know. I love picking on you too.
Michael, you must be lugging this. You must be have been lugging this stash of tone woods around from New York, right?
Well, I have some woods dating back to the 50s. And not that many. I've given a lot of it away to people who I felt deserved it, one of which was Steve Grimes over time. Uh-huh. He's built some wonderful instruments out of the wood. But I have enough to help my curmudgeon-y buddy, Mr.
Well, come
Dick.
On. You need my address?
talking about wood and thicknesses and so on, it depends on the wood that you pick and how you want to use it. For some of my ouds that I built, the top wood went down to 60 thousandths,
yeah,
without warping or twisting or doing anything. So a lot of it has to do with, as I said, selecting the wood that works for you. Mm-hmm. And so on.
Tom Humphrey had a guitar, and you could stick your finger right through the top if you wanted to. It had to be like 40 thousandths of an inch thick.
Yeah.
And that was just the strength of that wood that kept it from imploding, or the bracing, or everything?
Well, he had some lattice brace guitars, mm-hmm, and some that had lots of very thin braces underneath. I don't know what he really experimented a lot.
Yeah.
So years ago, I built a lot of flamenco guitars, and it was very hard to get Mediterranean cypress, and I experimented with yellow cedar, American yellow cedar, and built some fabulous, fabulous instruments. So there are alternatives, and instrument makers need to discover and explore some of the woods that are available to us right now. Mm-hmm. You know, not every instrument has to be built out of Brazilian rosewood.
And yeah, that's true. So, mahogany is a pretty light, for hardwoods, it's fairly light. And rosewood is at the heavier end of the spectrum, and all of the American hardwoods fall in between the two. There's so many options in exotic woods and in American hardwoods that can produce great instruments.
Mm-hmm. Michael, one of the things you never are a self-promoter. You rarely talk about all of your accolades and all the important stuff you've done in this industry. But Paul Simon is often seen toting one of your guitars. And I've heard through the grapevine that he actually wrote many of his hit songs on that Gurian. What's that Gurian? What do you remember what that guitar is?
Yeah, it was a size 3, 3-piece Brazilian rosewood guitar with I believe it was a Sitka spruce top.
And did he get that directly from you, or was he just buy that off a rack?
No, he got it directly from us. Mm-hmm. And we recently met up again last year in Hawaii after several years. And he had the instrument with him.
And it's incredible.
Yeah, he loves it. Still loves it.
That must have been so special to see him and to see that guitar after all those years.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he's a very sweet guy, really a good person. Yeah.
Did he have any special requests when he ordered that guitar from you?
No, he ordered a good size 3 guitar, and that was it. And I picked out the woods and did some of the work on it, but the whole company put their passion and love in it. So as they did with all the instruments that were made in Gershwin guitars.
Well, all of the people who worked for you, and a lot of them ended up going on to start their own guitar companies. You kind of fostered a whole generation of folks.
Yeah, I did. And that's what's getting me very upset lately, to see a lot of them, you know, passing on.
Yeah.
No, there's not too many left. But, you know, there's still some really great builders out there, and I'm glad that they're paying it forward. That's the important thing.
Totally. Well, the book is called An Instrument Maker's Guide to Insanity and Redemption, and I'm staring at a few dozen boxes of them here in my office. So they are available if anybody listening to this wants to order one. You do not have to be an instrument maker to appreciate this book, but I thoroughly loved it. And you guys, I'm happy to say, did not go completely insane. So you did find some redemption.
Well, how can you not go insane when you already are? Yeah.
Well, we'll try to send you some more customers too. We're doing some guitar shows together and separately, and we're going to make sure that people see the book and that you get more orders.
Oh, so. it's been flying off the shelf. It's been doing well, and a lot of names that weren't already in our database of customers. So word is getting around. It's really cool, and I'm just really happy that I could kind of be a little bit of a conduit to get it out into the world and work with you guys. You guys are amazing.
Well, we appreciate that. And we also, both of us are huge fans of Fretboard Journal, the best guitar-related, instrument-related magazine in the world. And one that is, every issue is so precious that you save it forever. The only thing is, I never know when I'm supposed to re-up.
I think you have a lifetime subscription at this point, Dick, so I don't think you have to worry.
Well, I want to keep supporting it.
Thank you. Well, thanks, guys.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to Jason. Thank you.
All right, that was my conversation with Dick Boak and Michael Gurian, two of my favorite people in the world of musical instruments, two of my favorite people to see at the NAMM show and at all the guitar shows and at the Fretboard Summit. I hope you enjoyed it. So stay tuned. Tell your friends about the Fretboard Journal podcast. You'd be surprised how many people are still not hip to the world of guitar podcasts. And as always, thank you for tuning in to the Fretboard Journal podcast.